fellow Americans. It's the 4th of July, and wouldn't you know, one of the Kennedys has a kid. How about that? I'll bet the Republicans are popping their cork all over, believe me, all over the country. 4th of July, one of the Kennedys. Oh, boy, we're talking about promotion stunt. You know, good evening, fellow Americans. I will award the Brass Piglegee with, since we're all fellow Americans, let us tonight, since it's the 4th of July, and tonight nobody is listening. That is anybody worth anybody. After all, there's a lot of strangers tonight, you know. You got very inhibited. There's a lot of people who are off tonight, Ed, who shouldn't be listening. There's a lot of people staying up tonight who shouldn't be staying up. Why don't you go to bed where you belong, fat slob? And, it's a terrible thing. Well, I think, though, since it is the 4th of July tonight, we might as well stop. We might as well just admit we're all Americans. We may be bugged, but we're Americans. We may be demonstrating. We may be getting ready to blow up the courthouse. We may be ready to burn down the city hall. But we are all Americans. You really can't escape that. No matter how many years a guy lives in Paris, he is still an American. I have a painter friend who lived a year in Paris. And he's influenced by the French painters, and he's been studying the great classics for years. This is a very, very interesting thing about being what you are inescapably. And he goes to Paris, and he's painting Paris. And everybody goes, of course, he's interested in everything, the wonderful sights and the feel and the smell and the quality and the colors, and he's painting Paris. Well, finally the big day arrives, and a big man from one of the big French galleries comes over, a big dealer. He's going to look at the guy's paintings. He takes one look at the paintings, and he says, Monsieur, you are painting American. All of your people are American, everyone. No Frenchmen. They're all American. But no matter how hard he tries, he will paint the Momar, he'll paint the Left Bank, he'll paint a small village in Normandy, but everybody walking up and down the streets are Americans. Well, you really cannot escape it. And one day, when I was in Nigeria, I think I told this story, but there's a great time to just... There's a brief story. I'll tell this story. It happened in Ibadan, in Nigeria. And this is a great kind of a day to tell it, the 4th of July. I'm in Ibadan about, 7-8 months ago, and it is unbelievably hot. Oh, boy, is it ever hot. Steamy hot. It's the kind of heat, you know, where even your skin is hot. You want to take your skin off. You know, like you take your BVDs off and your socks off. You want to strip your skin off, and somehow you feel your bones will get cool or something. It's so just terrible hot. And I'm kind of in the outskirts there, and there are millions of people. It's teeming. Oh, steaming. It's just like a gigantic cake of yeast. Life is everywhere. Life is crawling. It's flying. It's humming. It's buzzing. It's coming out of the ground. You breathe it in. It rains on you. Life is literally on just everywhere. Just all kinds of life. Bugs, insects, fungus, bacilli, everything. People, the whole business. The rivers are flowing. There's crocodiles. It's really alive. You just don't know how life is in Africa. No wonder people believe that life all sprang from Africa. It just had to come from there because, boy, is it ever going there. Well, I'm standing there in line waiting in a post office to buy some stamps. And I'm surrounded by thousands of Nigerians all waiting to send stuff and get things stamped. And I found that most post offices, no matter where you go, you stand. You just stand. You wait. You get in line. There's always a fat lady ahead of you who wants to send a letter to some wild place, and they can't figure out how to weigh it because it's got lumps on it. And she wants to send it a special way that they have to have a special stamp for, and she wants it insured under a special kind of insurance. So she's standing in front of me, and everybody is moving, and I'm waiting and waiting and waiting. And boy, they never heard from air conditioning in an Ibadan post office, I'll tell you that. It is hot. And so finally, I get up to the window, and up to this point, nobody has said a word to me. I get up to the window, and I say, I want 4 airmail stamps, please. You know, and of course, English is the language there in Nigeria. They all speak English, with a varying kind of accent, depending on where you go. Some of them speak it with an Igbo accent, others with a Hausa accent, some with an Oxfordian accent. Oh, the most fantastic English accent you ever heard. But they talk something like this. They say, what kind of stamp you want, sir? And I said, I'll have five airmail. 5 airmail stamps. Thank you, sir. 5 airmail stamps, that'll be 7 shillings, sir. And you give him the money. And I started to go out, and I turn around. And, you know, and there's one thing has to be said. It's very exciting to be in a place where there's a lot of life. Absolutely life everywhere. You can't help but be excited. And so I turn around, and I'm starting to go, when suddenly a guy in the line, about 2 people behind me, reaches out and touches my arm. A great big guy. He's about 6'6". And he's wearing a white shirt, and he's got a pair of these shorts that everybody wears over there, these white shorts that are cut down. Beautiful shorts they wear. Beautifully cut, and black shoes and high white socks, which is kind of a dress uniform and for hot weather. And he reaches out, and he touches me. And he says, you're an American, aren't you? Immediately, I could hear the American accent. He is an American. I said, yeah. He says, man, you got any time? He says, wait, I want to buy some stamps. Just wait for a second. So he goes up to the counter, and he buys some stamps, and he turns around. He's a great, big, gigantic, handsome, colored guy. And he turns around, and he comes over to me. He says, man, he says, you're an American. And I said, yeah. We just stand there. He says, you got a car? He says, I got a car. Can I take you any place? And I says, yeah, I'm going so forth. And I told him where I was going. He says, oh, boy. We get out in front of the place, and the sun, boom, the sun hits down on us, and the pigs are running all over the place, and the sewers are running over our feet, and the whole business, you know. But it's a wildly exciting place. You have an idea that would sound terrible, but it isn't. It's very exciting when you're there, and has no parallel to what it would be like here if the same things were going on here. It's very different, very exciting. And the sun, boom, boy. Hits down, and we get out on the concrete steps of this little post office, little winding road, and the shops are going up one way and up the other way, and all kinds of people are swirling. The streets teem, literally teem. Bicycles, Volkswagens, guys on pogo sticks, guys carrying other guys in sedans. Oh, everything you can't imagine. It's a sea of humanity flowing of people yelling and hollering, big yellow robes and purple robes and blue robes and sun helmets. I remember one guy, Ed, one of the great sights that I've seen was a guy riding a bicycle. And he had some kind of a light, almost a silk robe. And it was the most translucent blue. It was the color of a very light, sunshiny blue sky. It was that kind of blue. Their colors are all like that. Someday, American people are going to discover Nigerian colors. Incredible. And he had this light blue robe with a light blue skull cap. And on top of the light blue skull cap was a gigantic wooden bowl. And in this enormous wooden bowl, there must have been 45 yelling, hollering pigs. Little pigs all tied up with their feet, you know. And they're looking out, they're looking out of the bowl and wiggling. Well, this guy is riding down the street on a bicycle that had wheels that were 4 times the size of any bicycle wheels I ever saw. And going like the wind. And his robe is floating out back of him like an enormous flag. He's going along, and his feet are going back and forth, and he's got this bowl on the top of his head, and the pigs are yelling, and he's just going along as calm, and the wind is blowing. He goes down the street. Boy, now there's skill, guts. So we get out on the street, me and this guy, and he turns to me, and he says, let me tell you, man. He says, I can't tell you how great it is to hear in America. And I said, boy, I said, what are you doing in here? You know, wow. We didn't know quite what to say. I was so glad to talk to somebody who, for a strange reason, you get very hungry for American things when you are a million miles away. No matter how hip you are, you just do. You get hungry for them. And so I said, gee, wow. So we got into his car, which was a Nash. And every car in this place, of any consequence at all, has practically, the sun has beaten the paint right off. It's just peeled it right off. They're a peculiar slate colored. And we get into this guy's Nash, and we sit down there, and he said, Matt, he said, you got any time? And I says, yeah, I'm not going anyplace. He said, let me tell you. He said, I just want to tell you how great it is to talk to an American. He says, I've been inland. He says, I've been here for 7 months. And he says, I just can't tell you how great it is. And so, well, of course, I was delighted. So we went over to a place, and we're having a drink. And it turns out that he of all things, was a listener from Brooklyn. I wonder if any of his people are listening tonight. It's a wild thing. He was there working for an American film company as some kind of an export expert. And in the course of the conversation, this is what he said. I'll try to reproduce it almost verbatim. And he's a big, handsome, I'd say he was about 25 or 26. And I believe he went to Brooklyn College. And I told him who I was. He's who? No. Oh, come on, man. You're putting me on. I said, no, Gene Shepherd, you know. He said, the night people, man. He said, oh, no. He said, I listened to, oh, no. It's impossible. We're hollering and yelling and drinking gin tonics, you know, and getting hotter. And so in the course of the conversation, he says to me, you know, he says, man, he says, it's I had to come all the way over here to realize that I am first and foremost, no matter what I do, I am an American. He said, man, I just discovered it. And he says, boy, he says, there's plenty of troubles at home. He says, but I know one thing. I am an American. And it was a very strange thing to hear in Ibadan. Not strange at all, though, if you understand really what you are. If you really understand what you are, you often don't really know. And so we sat around and we drank the gin tonics and hollered. And then finally, I had to go, and his Nash took off into the bush. Boy, he took off. He said, oh, man. He said, I can hardly wait to get back there. I can hardly wait to get back to Brooklyn. He grabbed me. Fantastic, gigantic paw. He grabbed me up and down. My shoulders jiggled. and off he went. And I wonder if he's still out there. It's curious. And I went back. I went back and I sat. And this is the kind of thing that really, really wildly makes you really conscious of many things. I at that night I was going back to Lagos, and I arrived on the main road. Finally got back into Lagos, and they have a gigantic hotel in Lagos, which is honestly it makes the new Hilton look like the old Plaza. You can't believe such a wildly super modern hotel can exist. Well, it looks out over the Bay of Guinea. There, hot, and the steamers are going past. I'm sitting in the sundown area there, having a drink, and a man comes up to me. And he turns out to be, with a strange accent, this kind of, he sort of talked like, he says, well, how are you enjoying your trip here? A very peculiar, almost Germanic, but not quite accent. I couldn't figure out what he was. And we're sitting talking, having a drink, and just talking. And it turns out that he was from Poland. And he was obviously a top-flight communist. But I did not know what he was for maybe 2.5 hours, because we didn't discuss where we were from. We just knew we were... I assumed he was German, because a lot of Germans around there. And I guess he knew I was an American. It shows all over my map. That's the end of it. I'm an American. Well, I never heard in all of my life... And remember, this man is from the Great People's Democratic Republic. And I thought he was German. I never heard more virulent and more completely realized racial talk in my life than this guy was coming out with about Nigeria and about the whole world. I couldn't figure out what is that? Boy, and I'm listening to this thing, and then it suddenly comes out. He is from one of the Great People's Republic. And all of a sudden, something opened. I don't know what it was, but something opened up, man. Speaking of totalitarianism, this is WOR, AM and FM, New York. But you know, this is the 4th of July. And not to be particularly patriotic or anything, but it is a funny thing about the 4th of July. No other place in the world celebrates this truly. It's almost a truly American type of celebration. It really has nothing to do with the wars, you know. It has nothing to do with the independence and all that. I don't know what it is. It's celebrating being what you are in a peculiar way, and nobody knows really that they're doing it. But 4th of July is not really 4th of July unless it is incredibly hot. I think this is a dud of a 4th of July. Don't you agree? Because 4th of July, by tradition, has to be like a white Christmas. The 4th of July has to be insufferable, like you can't breathe. And probably even now, tonight, because we're doing this show, it's the 4th of July, and I know that there are 87 million guys parked bumper to bumper in traffic jams going all the way from Jones Beach, probably somewhere south of Trenton. one solid chunk of metal, all sitting there yelling and hollering. But the one thing they miss is the incredible heat. I can remember traffic jams on the 4th of July that could not be believed. And another thing, of course, is the firework phenomenon. You don't want me to tell some firework stories now, do you? Genuine fireworks. I think that our world has changed so much, and one of the way it has changed, and this is not a nostalgic program by any means, we have kind of drifted away from a kind of violence that everyone took for granted. The 4th of July was one of the most violent holidays anywhere in the world. You know, they have plenty of violent holidays. Have you ever seen the running of the bulls at Pompeii? Oh, boy. When the bulls chase the guys up and down the streets and they get gored and run over and kicked by the bulls in Spain. Well, it's nothing at all compared to an American 4th of July. Because you see, my old man, and I had a very special... a very special identification with the 4th of July. When it was announced the 4th was coming, young Shepherd became very big in the neighborhood because my father ran a 4th of July stand about 2 weeks or 3 weeks before 4th of July. We would go out and we would get in our supply, tremendous supply of fireworks. You know, you read the term fireworks today. You know, they're illegal. I will award you a brass figurine if you can identify the types of fireworks that were private fireworks. I don't mean the kind that the great big celebrations would fire. What was that little red thing called with the paper wrapper? A little red thing about the size of a quarter. It was flat. It was a kind of a tablet, a dark red tablet with dark red paper on it, and it was used to scrape on the sidewalk. It would make a line. It would burn. It was a nasty little piece of fireworks. And then you would grind it under your heel. It would give you a hot foot. Now, what was the name of that thing? You remember that little nasty, rotten thing? And for days after the 4th of July, when you walk around on the sidewalks, you would see these scratches, and you would rub your foot on them, and they'd pop again. You remember that? All over. You know, the scars of fireworks would be all over town for maybe 2 weeks after the 4th of July. You were always finding spent fire rockets, all kinds of rockets. You'd find Roman candles in the bushes. True? There was another one. Now, can you tell me the name of that thing? All right. What was the name of the thing? Now listen to this one now. What was the name of the thing that was it was like a little aspirin tablet that was honed off around the top. It was in the form of a cone. And you would put it down, and you would light that little son of a gun. And a long thing would start to come out of it and just twist. You remember a gray thing? It would just twist out. Do you remember that thing? A long, twisting ash. What was the name of that? Boy, are you guys, I'm telling you, what kind of Americans are you? Then there was another one. Okay, there was another big conical thing. It was about 4 or 5 inches high. You could buy these things in about 9 sizes. Some of them would come in the big half-dollar size, but the usual one was about 3 or 4 inches high. It was like an upside-down ice cream cone, usually covered with silver paper, or sometimes red, white, and blue paper, and right out of the top of it would come a wick. And you would light this thing, and it would send up a high shower of sparks. It would go shh, red, white, and blue, and pink, and yellow sparks. Do you remember that thing? What was the... Yes, you did have them. You did, too. What was that one called? All right. What was the one called that was like looked like a gigantic firecracker? This thing came in the quarter size, the 10-cent size. It came in the dollar size. It was so big it came with a shoulder holster, you know, and firing instructions and all that. It looked like a gigantic firecracker that was about a foot high, and it was about 2 inches around, and it had a little wooden base on it. And it was in 3 colors, red, white, and blue. And it had big wick coming out of the top of it. And when you would light that thing, it would go like this. And then you'd hear... You'd see that little dot going straight up in the air. And then it would go... 2 big cracks up there about 4 miles up. What was the name of that one? You remember that thing? Well, the reason I know about these things is because fireworks were an integral part of my life as a kid. And my old man, three things, actually. He was hung on the White Sox. He was hung on used cars and fireworks. He was an absolute nut on fireworks. And he had gone into the business, and now he was selling them. And every 2 weeks before the fireworks, you know, were to be fired off, outside of town, outside of Chicago, all the roads outside of Chicago, there'd be hundreds of roads because there was a law saying you could not sell fireworks inside the city limits. And outside the city limits, of course, in fact, half of the cops had fireworks stands outside the city limits. And for miles around, you would see these little wooden stands that had been selling tomatoes up to now, you know, and all kinds of things like pumpkins and stuff. All of a sudden, they had red, white, and blue bunting, and there'd be a great big sign that would say, Excelsior Fireworks. Excelsior was one of the big names. There was another big name among fireworks. You remember that other one? What was the other great fireworks company? Come on. Big. They were like the General Motors of the fireworks world. They probably killed more people than World War II with their product. But anyway, every year we would set up our business, and we would have these big 5-inchers. We'd have the 3-inchers. We'd have the 2-inchers. We'd have the cherry bombs. We'd have the pinwheels, and all of it would be set up on the tables in back of us. And about this time of the night on 4th of July, just about this time, about 20 minutes to midnight, the business would be petering out, of course, because the 4th of July would be over at midnight, and the old man is frantically hoping that nobody comes, because then he can explode all the rest of the stuff in his own fantastic display at home. He'd take it all in a big truck and blow it off all at once. Well, about this time, I can remember, one of the real phenomenons was apparently in those days, a lot of guys impressed their chicks by buying fireworks. And I, as a kid, you know, I was always working in the fireworks stand. And for some reason or other, in spite of the fact I was a firework nut, I hated working in the stand. I really hated it. It was hot, you know, crummy. And all the other kids were, you know, shooting fireworks. I'm standing in there making change. I'm standing in there. And about every 5 minutes, some guy in a big Huffmobile would drive up with a cutie, with a blonde, you know. And I get out, and he's playing the big man. All right, baby. What do you want? Yeah, what do you want? And they're pointing at all these great, you know, he's always impressing the chicken. All the big stuff, all the the big artillery he's pointing at. Oh, give me that big one over there. What's the name of that big one? That great big one. How much is that? That's $1.50. God, come on, give me two of them. Two of them. I want two of the big fireworks. Give me one of the rockets over there, and I want some. You got any Roman candles, kid? Give me a bag of Roman candles, the big ones. Yeah, I don't want all the kids. No sparklers. I want the big stuff. Well, he'd buy $20 worth of this stuff. And you'd see him go driving off the road. And about 30 seconds, he'd be just about out of sight when you'd hear... You'd see his car reel around. He has tried to light a cherry bomb with his cigar and has not made it. Oh, boy, I'll tell you, we used to keep in our fireworks stand, 18 pounds of unguentine. We had more rolls of gauze and tannic acid because our product was always working too soon. There was nothing like a guy walking out. They'd walk out of the fireworks stand. They'd get about 5 feet away, and some idiot, some big, fat, cigar-smoking, butter and egg man would have a handful of torpedoes. He'd say, hey, watch this, baby! Boom, boom, pow! Next thing you know, he's got 4 pounds of pebbles in his foot. Hey, Kaflippin, what kind of stuff you selling me, for God's sake? Look at that. Well, then I've got out the unguentine. I'm taking his shoe off, and I'm putting the stuff, all the big fat guys getting in their Rolls Royces and their Packards, driving away. And then there used to be the inevitable. This was another one. The inevitable big car would drive up. Great big car, you know, with the real rich city people in it. And they would drive up, and this little skinny kid would get out of the back, and his father, all dressed up. You know, there's a certain look that important rich people have when they are in the country or they're on a picnic. They look vaguely uncomfortable all the time. They always have two-tone shoes, you know, that kind of thing on the beach. You know, it just doesn't quite make it. And they get out. And they come over, and he says,
Timothy, now you just choose anything you want. I want you to be happy today. And little Timothy stands there looking at all the fireworks. You can see that he has no more desire to have fireworks than he wants a wart on the top of his head. And he's standing there, and the old man said, well, come on, Timothy, we haven't got all day, you know. Mother's waiting in the car, and we'd like to get home and have our celebration. And little Timothy is saying, I have one of those. Do you have any sparklers? And you go back, and you get him some sparklers. And the old man is then, of course, taking over. He says, well, Timothy, wouldn't you like to have one of those? And they always point at the big things. The kid doesn't know what it is. You know, big thing with handles on it, and it comes with 40-millimeter sights, and it has a big shock mounting, and it's for blowing up towns, you know, that kind of thing. It's for the mafia. And wouldn't you like one of those, Timothy? The thing with the wheels there. I'll wrap one of those up. Would you please wrap one of them? How much are they? $5, fine. Well, what else would you like, Tim? And little Timothy is picking. The kids always pick the little things. You know, what's the little thing there? All the little thing with a little handle on it that you squeeze with your thumb and the wheel goes around and makes little sparks, you know. The old man doesn't buy this kind of stuff. He wants the big things. And so pretty soon they've got a load of about $50 worth of stuff, and they take it off and they put it in the back of that great big fat Cadillac, and the little kid sits in the back by the bag, and the mother's sitting up in front, and the father gets in. You can see the father's not even used to driving the car. Their man drives the car, but they're out celebrating the Fourth. You see, it's a family celebration. So he gets in the front. You can hear him shifting gears badly, you know. He goes from right into second. He doesn't even bother with first. And away goes that big Buick down the road. And you see this little tiny head in the back. They're off to celebrate being an American. I've always had a feeling, you know, I can always see some servant somewhere lighting the Roman candles. Jeeves is shooting off the sky rockets, you know, and out there with his tails. Well, that'd be enough, sir. How about a few sparklers now? And he lights the sparklers and waves them, and the kids say, gee, that's great. Well, I do. This firework thing is pretty wild. Some of the great traumatic experiences of my kid life were with my father's failure, often with fireworks. Fireworks are sneaky. Did I ever tell you about the time, the terrible episode of the backfiring Roman candle? Well, you know they have Roman candles that have, they come in various sizes. Some of them have 4 or 5 shots. Some of them will have 10. Some of them will have 15. And then when you get the big bazooka-style Roman candle, these are the big ones, you know. This is the true mafia thing. They use it for cannonading the next mountain, that kind of thing. Don't you know what a Roman candle is? Oh, sure, everybody knows. Well, we used to have usually about 15 of these we'd lay in stock. And by the time midnight of the 4th of July would arrive, we would have sold maybe, 10. We'd be left with 5 of these beauties. Fantastic $5 Roman candles. They were about 5 feet tall. Great big babies. They were as tall as me as a kid, you know. And they were about 3 inches around. And they had a big shoulder holster and a strap, and you'd hold this son of a gun behind you. And you know there's a technique in shooting Roman candles. And my old man was a pure show-off. He was the kind of guy who was noted at the parties for a thing he called the snake dance. It was just a wiggle. He'd just wiggle, you know, went around and wear a lampshade. He was that kind, you know. So everything he did, he always said there is style to it, but it was terrible now that I think about it. He used to play pool. And he would do the shots behind the back, you know, that kind of stuff. Watch this, you know. Oh, he was a real pool shark. He would do that kind of stuff. Or he would say, watch this now. He'd take the bowling ball, you know, one hand up. He would go, whoop, he'd turn around, throw it behind him. Boom, right in the pocket. That kind of stuff. He was always catching balls behind his back, you know, tossing them over his shoulder and throwing them, that kind of jazz. Well, when he had Roman candles, this is the way he would do it. He would take the Roman candle and light it. He would move back and hold it down low. He would count to himself. It's like rhythm, see? It would go... And as soon as that fuse would go in, he would start moving it around in a circle. It would go... He would feel that ball coming up. He'd go... And he'd sort of move forward and buck his fanny around to the left and down again. It was like he was helping them, you know, and putting body English on them as they go up. he'd put in shoots on them. You know, they'd go up and you'd see this big in shoot. Or he'd throw a flutter ball up there. We'd go. Or he'd throw a beautiful drop, a sinker. We'd go whoop, whoop, and go up. He was pitching with the Roman candles. Well, one night, the whole neighborhood would gather around. They would gather around to watch my old man shoot the fireworks, because nobody had anything like the amount of money worth of fireworks we had. He'd have maybe $200-$300 in retail of fireworks left, usually. And that's a gigantic box. And about midnight, he'd start firing out back of the house in the alley. Nobody ever thought of even going into a field to do this kind of stuff in those days. Just stand on the alley, you know, the houses around and the windows, the people in the wash hanging out, and he's shooting off this heavy artillery. So he's standing back there this night. One of the great, absolutely unparalleled moments of my life. And also one of those things, you know, where you feel so terrible because your old man has really flubbed. You know, really done an awful thing. Well, he's got this Roman candle. Everything's been going fine. Big 14-foot pinwheels he's got. He's got things that spell out Abraham Lincoln, and they light up, you know. He's got giant American flags that fly up in the air and come down on balloons. Everything's going. And finally, he takes out the Roman candle, which was the thing he always really dug more than any. Lights it, and everybody's standing around there. Off goes the first one. A great big green ball goes up, and everybody, you know, you hear the crowd. Mrs. Bruner is sweating and hollering. When suddenly, that Roman candle, at about the third ball, shoots backward. Right out of the back end of this thing comes a ball. Whoop! Like that. Just as my old man is winding up. Whoop! Right up his sleeve and right out the back of his shirt. So help me, I'm telling you. He spins around. He's got this pongee shirt on. He spins around. Whoop! Another ball goes out the front. And then quickly, two of them come out the back. He is going around like he's insane. He throws the darn thing. It flies up and goes into Flick's backyard, right in the middle of geraniums. Boom, boom, up both ends. He turns around and he's screaming bloody murder. His shirt is on fire. My shirt! Oh, my God, my shirt! He runs up the alley. He was the best piece of fireworks himself the whole night. You know, you could see him trailing smoke and flame. the whole neighborhood as well. But the thing that has to be pointed out is that nobody worried. I mean, it was just natural in the fireworks world. He runs down in the basement and turns the hose on, and they're pouring water on him. They're rubbing lard and goose grease on him. 5 minutes later, he's out in the backyard shooting off rockets. Shirt hanging in tatters, his shirt tail gone, one sleeve out. There is a picture, boy, of an American celebrating something. Who knows what? Well, you know, that attitude towards infernal destruction was part of it. It was a completely blasé attitude. One of the things that kids did in the height of the firework boom was to gather all the squibs. You remember the squibs, Ed. A squib was a firecracker that just didn't go off, you know. They would keep gathering them all day long as you know, you'd shoot. Sometimes the most common thing you'd do with a squib would be to bust it in the middle. Just bust it and pour a little of the powder out and light it, you know. It sort of squibs around. Yeah, it squibs around a little bit. And that's why they called it a squib. It made a squibbing sound. Go like that. The squib a little bit. Once in a while, you'd light it and you'd hold it in your hand. It would squirt a little flame out. Well, we would gather all these squibs on this one gigantic, memorable occasion that I know, I know 26 guys still remember on this very night. We are in the backyard. We are in Bruner's backyard. We have gathered about 5 pounds of squibs. Somebody gets a bucket, a regular big bucket, you know, the kind of, the basement kind of bucket, you know, they use for scrubbing, big bucket. He gets, because I get the bucket, and don't ask me, I don't know what nuttiness prompted us to do it. We take our squibs, and we're all emptying them in the bucket, you know, emptying squibs, about a half a pound of squibs, you know, we're emptying in the bucket. We're all emptying the black powder and the silver powder, a couple of big cherry bombs that didn't go off. We now got a pile, really, a pile that's about a half pound, you know, a nice little pile of squibs. So we all stand around the bucket, Flick lights a match, drops it in. There is a blue flash. Nobody sees anything but little lights, stars, circles, balls going off for about 3 minutes, no eyebrows. 26 kids without an eyebrow among them. Just gone. No eyebrows. Our eyelashes gone. Our faces are beet red. We stand around. I'll never forget going into Miss Robinette's class. The whole class is sitting there, not an eyebrow in the class, except among the chicks. 26 kids sitting there with red faces. Well, now, the thing that is interesting, though, is going home on a day like that. Nobody said anything except, I told you not to get too close to them. That's all. That was about the extent of it. And the whole firework, I'll tell you, one of the most, speaking of fireworks, one of the most, I don't know whether they still do it or not, but a couple of nights ago, we talked about the Great Lakes and the lake boats, these huge lake boats. Well, there was a thing that used to happen if it's happening, it's happening right now. It used to start about 11 o'clock and go to roughly 1 o'clock in the morning. One of the big lake boats, whatever lake boat happened to be in at Inland Steel, would take off about 10 o'clock at night and go about 5 or 6 miles out just beyond the breakwater, you know, and just anchor out there or hang out there in the darkness. And about this time of the night, they would begin to fire off gigantic fireworks off of the top of this boat. One after the other, these enormous things would go and hang out over the water, you know, come down, just boom, and they'd go up, and of course the beach is just black with people, millions of people, all hock deep there watching this thing, and you could see the oily water, and you could smell the steel mills, and you could smell the Lever Brothers plant down the ways making the soap, and you could smell the Amazo plant making the corn oil, whatever that does, and you could smell the fish in the water and the lake, and you could smell the heat, and all the while laying out there in that water is this big ore boat, and she's shooting this stuff off. Well, one of the big sea disasters occurred one year as a result of that. It wasn't really, it was kind of a funny sea disaster in a way. You could see these things firing. We're down there on the beach, kids and people and Boy Scouts. In fact, I was with a Boy Scout troop that night. It was a big thing to go down there and watch the ore boat shoot off the stuff. And we're all standing down there, and the whole point of this was that it is going to be the safest kind of fort. That's safe. You know, to go down there and watch the ore boat. Well, we're watching the ore boat shoot the stuff off, and everything is going up, when suddenly we begin to see that the demonstration is getting even more spectacular than usual. You get a big skyrocket goes up. Pew, one of these big things with the big mushrooms are going off out there. Pew, and then we see that what looks like they're shooting off sparklers on the deck. And then we can hear some shouting, yelling and hollering. And then there's a dull, and there's a gigantic shot of flame comes out of the back end of the boat. And with that, from all directions, you could see tugs coming. Ooh, they have radioed in the shore. We are sinking fast. We have just blown each other up with the Roman candles. And the boat is blowing up. And these guys are still shooting the stuff off out there. One after the other. They're shooting it off. They want to get it all gone before they get off the boat. It's going off. It was wild. We're watching. The people are cheering. And the first, what do you think the first reaction of the people was? To cheer it. Oh, the people loved it. The boat is on fire. They're squirting it with water. Everyone thinks it's part of the display. It's part of the great 4th of July display of U.S. sea power or something. They're squirting it. The boat is burning. And about 20 minutes later, they tug it in, you know, and you can see the flame, and the guys are in the rowboats, and people are walking around, and everyone drifts back and says, wasn't that a wonderful fort? That was just a great 4th of July. You know, speaking of safe 4th of Julys, do you recall, it was in all the headlines, about 2 or 3 years ago, I believe it was in Philadelphia, about 25,000 people are gathered in a park to watch a display of fireworks by these fireworks experts. Do you remember that? And they start to shoot the stuff off, and everybody's watching, when suddenly the fireworks starts to get on fire, where the guys are shooting it off, and within 30 seconds, more Roman candles and more fireworks, more bombs, are going off in the crowd. Boom! Right into the crowd. People are screaming and hollering. You remember that? Oh, sure, that was a big story. I don't know how many people got it that night, celebrating the 4th of July. But probably the biggest fiasco I ever saw in connection with the celebration of the 4th of July at home was again connected with my father. It was the kind of thing that you always suspect happens in the funny paper, but rarely happens in life. The old man had about, I would say on this night, he had probably $350 worth of fireworks at depression prices. This would have filled the average, I'd say 2-ton truck up twice. He had a load of fireworks that didn't stop. And he had them in two gigantic cardboard boxes. Great big boxes. Well, in the typical nutty, I don't know whether people are more, have got more sense now or what. I can't tell what it is. But even a 5-year-old kid wouldn't do this kind of thing anymore. But my father did it, and nobody questioned it. He put this two great big box load full of fireworks on the ground next to a telephone pole out in the alley. Now, he shoots. The first thing he does was to put in the ground on a big piece of angle iron an enormous skyrocket, which he lights off. He always would start off the evening with a big 4-pound skyrocket. They were fantastic. That was the most exciting. That was early space projects. It really was. So he lights this thing and it goes, off she goes, and everybody stands there. Nobody noticed that he's shooting off the fireworks. He shot off his rocket. He is not 2.5 feet away from all of his boxes of firecrackers, his bagel bombs, his space bombs, his Mount Vesuvius's, all the stuff. He's just, he puts it right down there by the box. So the next thing he does is right above the box, he nails in a great big pinwheel that had about a 4-foot circumference. He lights the thing. It's going. And everybody's saying, isn't that beautiful? Isn't that? 14,000 pounds of sparks are going into those boxes every revolution. Boom! It goes, pow! Wow! Boom! Bang! Stuff is shooting. People are yelling. Bruner is in the basement screaming. Kids are crying. The old man is beating it with a fire. He's strutting around hitting it. Go! Sticks! Boom! Pow! Well, that explosion went on for a good 20 minutes. It tore down fences. It killed goats. It broke windows. It burned hedges. It knocked down telephone wires. You could hear sirens coming from blocks around. And the only regret that anybody had was that the old man shot him off all at once. That's all people worried about, all at once. 10 minutes and it's all gone. We've been waiting all night. Boom, pow, crash. Up it went. Oh, it's tough being an American. It's one of the hardest jobs in the world.